Hey there. Welcome to the table, podcast edition. My name's Tim. Typically, I'm the voice you hear in these podcasts, but this one's a little different from our usual fare. For the second year running, we went as a community to a wonderful space here in Winnipeg called the Kapawea-Chuck Healing Forest. I'll let the forest keeper, Kyle Mason, explain what that's all about in the podcast. Kyle is joined by Elder Don Robinson, who will tell a bunch of his story to us over the course of the podcast as well. I would say settle in to hear some deep, hard-won wisdom from folks who've traveled a difficult road and whose lives are being poured out in beautiful, kind, caring ways in the interest of reconciliation and of us being able to live together as all peoples in better ways than we have in the past going forward. I should mention the space is outside, as one might expect of a forest. And we recorded this as it happened. And so it's not as easy to listen to sonically because there's noises and variations and all the things that go with being outdoors. But we pretty much left it intact so you can have at least part of the sonic experience that we got to share together, because the space matters as well as the words. All to say, welcome to the table. Welcome to the podcast. Thanks for dropping by. Here's Kyle.
Hello, everybody. Maguch. Morning, bonjour. Thank you for having me. Appreciate you guys coming back year to year. And as a member of the, we call it the Keepers of the Forest, a.k.a., put it in white man's terms, member of the board of the Healing Forest, from near day one, you know, it's been a pleasure to see groups like yours come down and enjoy this space. But before I get into all of that, it would be improper of me if not to introduce myself in a proper way. So my father, his name was Dr. Raymond Mason. He was an elder from Peguis First Nation. Yeah, we come from a line of a direct descendant of a gentleman named Chief Peguis. Anybody ever hear of that guy? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Might have driven down his road or had family go to his junior high, or I think he even has a street now. And but yeah, so that's where my father's side of the family comes from. My mother's family comes from Manicotagan, which is about an hour north of Pine Falls, a Métis community, where my grandfather and my grandmother were some of the co-founders of the Manitoba Métis Federation. So my family, no matter what side you look at, has long, deep roots onto this land, long before there ever was a thing called Canada or anything like that. And recently, a friend was asking me, where did my family historically live? And actually, right here, along these riverbanks between basically here and the Forks was our people's land up until we were forcibly relocated to where now the city of Selkirk is. Until they decided they wanted that space, until we were forcibly located in Glorified Swamp, which is now the present day Peguis First Nation. And so my family, I have not wandered far from my family roots. I wouldn't be surprised if some of my ancestors literally lived on this land where I live, a few blocks away on Cathedral, just down the street from one of your friends named Brett. And more recently, with my father, he was a residential institution survivor. I don't say school because they were anything but schools. And my mother was forced to go to a day school in her high school years. Whereas I also grew up with my mother and my siblings here in this neighborhood, where we were under-resourced and at times struggled with secure housing, food security, that kind of stuff. And we're not for friends and family, sometimes taking us in or dropping off baskets of food, things would have been even more difficult. Myself, after high school, I went off and got a degree in biblical studies and launched my career as a pastor. And I realized a year into that, oh my word, I've made a terrible mistake. I didn't want to be a pastor anymore. And to put it bluntly, I had no issues with Jesus or Jesus' teachings. I just had issues with Christians. Because often Christians are the last people it seemingly too often are the last people that actually follow the teachings of Jesus about loving people unconditionally, serving them unconditionally, and just respecting people unconditionally. Sometimes these days, they're much more concerned about things that are not even mentioned within the Bible. And I couldn't deal with that. So I pivoted into nonprofit management, spent most of my career now working in inner city, North End nonprofit management, largely known for starting and running a nonprofit called the North End Family Center, which I ran for a decade. And since then, I've run and been a part of other nonprofits, but also for the last 7 years now, I've been an Indigenous consultant and speaker, where I speak with groups to either help them start or grow on their road to becoming a strong ally, and helping them understand better so we can have a better present and a better future, because the past has been troubled, to say the least. And this healing forest, which is pronounced Kapawayachuk Healing Forest, has been here now for about 7-8 years. It's been growing, and its presence. We are a nonprofit, so we do seek support. Thankfully, the St. John's Cathedral, which is behind me, has been a major supporter. And if you ever want to give towards this space, you can give it through the cathedral, and they'll be happy to give you a tax receipt. And they've been a strong partner. But yeah, this space, the Healing Forest, we wanted to make sure that it was a space for healing and remembering all the tens of thousands of children that did not survive the forced kidnapping and attempted genocide of our lives, our cultures, our languages, our spirituality. Tens of thousands of these children did not ever come back home. They died in these institutions, away from their friends, their family, their culture, their land, anything that made them them, they were forcibly kidnapped from. You see, I don't like to say that they were taken or that these children attended these institutions. Attending sounds like there was some choice. More often than not, there was no choice. The Indian agents or the RCMP would come to our communities and forcibly take our children away from us. Who here have some special little ones in their lives, whether they're kids, grandkids, nieces, nephews, whatever? Yeah. Who here would have any issues if the RCMP came to your door and later today and took those kids from you? Yeah. And what would be their justification? Yeah, because of your culture and your skin color. It's horrific. It sounds like a bad movie. But as you all know, I'm sure, it was what was happening throughout the majority of the country of Canada. And in some ways, in a different way, it is still happening. It just migrated from the residential institutions to this thing called the 60 Scoop to modern-day child and family services. Because who here out of the... I'm gonna ask another question. There's about 11,000 children in the CFS system here in Manitoba. What percentage do you think are Indigenous of those children? Anybody? 85, 90. Anybody else? Sorry? You're actually the closest. It's about 94 point something percent. So over 10,000 children in the CFS system today in Manitoba are Indigenous. Why is that? Are we bad parents? Are we bad grandparents? Were the colonizers correct that we needed our kids taken away from us? No, of course not. This is the present day and everlasting impact of hundreds of years of racism and colonization, treating our people as less than, and this is just the continuation of that. So I'm getting a little off topic here, but if you ever want to call yourself a strong ally of Indigenous peoples, you need to fight and work against present-day systems of injustices like the CFS system and the reasons to why nearly 95% of our children are in that system. we're also disproportionately overrepresented in the jail system, the health system, the unemployed system, the lower education levels, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's almost every system you do not want to be a part of, we are overrepresented. And that is not because we're bad people or just, this is the, what should have been a predictable outcome of generations of racism and colonization and genocide towards our peoples. So there's still a lot of work to be done. And this healing forest is one small aspect of that. This is a space for, like I said, remembering the tens of thousands of children that were murdered or died at these institutions. But it's also to respect the survivors, the children that did eventually make it out. But even if they did make it out of these institutions, they were not the same. Our communities were not the same. They often felt difficulties coming back to our communities and to our families. If you think about it, culture, morals, religion, etc., are all passed down through the family unit. And for generations, that was taken from us. So, while they are survivors, there is still a lot of healing that needs to be done. Not only from, you know, from our elders who attended these institutions to people like me, where one generation removed, or my son, who's two generations removed from these institutions, there's still a lot of healing needed being done. That being said, there's still a lot of strength within our communities. We have endured, we have survived, and we are healing. And one day we're going to take over again. Just wait. Oh, I shouldn't have said that part out loud, right? We were supposed to keep that secret. Yeah, never mind. Strike that part. Yeah. So this space, again, is a space of remembering the children who did not survive, remembering and engaging with our survivors, but also to have conversations like this where we can talk with each other and respectful, equal relationships, and where people can come together to do ceremony and do community events. Since this spot has been here, we've had church services, we've had graduations, we've had funerals, we have had family picnics, we've had almost every type of ceremony and gathering you can have here on this space. And it has been purposely designed where these logs do not have things in the middle of them, so if our unhoused brothers and sisters need a place to lie down in the night, they can come lie down here. And of course, it's designed in a way that we're in a circle so we could talk and see each other. Mm-hmm. Over there, you'll see some of our medicines and some of our flowers that have been largely removed from the landscape of this land. You also see the four boulders in the four directions. And I encourage you after the service to take some time to walk around them. We have our ancestors and some of our kin within these boulders. You'll see where the artist has painted and done things to help reveal the presences that are within these boulders. Every time I come, I always see new faces, new aspects. Some of the more obvious ones is over behind this gentleman. You could see the two wolves in that boulder. Mm-hmm. So, again, welcome. Thank you for coming again. We hope you guys come here often, either as a church or as individuals. Anybody and everybody is welcome here. And I want to pass it over to you, sir.
Thank you. I've been here another time. We did an activity with the people that are homeless. We were here. We had a barbecue here and a gathering with the people, some of the people I work with at Mama Wichita Center. People that are looking for housing. So we sat here, we had burgers, hot dogs. We had a good time with the people that were here. We used the space. So I'm glad to be here today again. Nice to be invited by your group. And just to introduce myself, Wastebino Maikan Enos Nigasan, Maikan Dutem. That's my spirit name. It means lightning wolf. I'm from the wolf clan. I come from northern Manitoba, Treaty 5 territory, Panpanipi Cree Nation, which is Oxford House. And I was born there in 1951. And right now my community is on fire. They're all the people are here in the city. Most of them are in the city and are in Brandon and Portage la Prairie and waiting for the fire to go out. So they're hoping for rain and hoping for the fire to be controlled, contained, so they can return home. So I was born there and I grew up there and I, for the first decade of my life, and I remember I had to look back in retrospect to find, to remember what, to know what happened to my community, to know, because I didn't know as I was growing up what my community was going through. But my community was established in 1798 by the Hudson Bay Fur Trading Company as a supply post, and so they started to create a fort there, a supply fort, and people, my ancestors were people who hunted, fished and trapped. They were migratory people, and so they traveled in family groups and around the area there. They had their own territory. But when the Hudson Bay Supply Post was created, they started to stay around the fort, around that supply fort, and so we became more of a community. As people started working for the company, as fur traders, hunters, and trappers of the involved with the fur trade. So seven, 8 generations ago is when my community started being part of that area, an established community. And in 1912, they became part of Treaty 5. They signed on to Treaty Number 5. And we became part of the Indian Act. They established a reserve there, and they called it Oxford House. And most recently, our community reclaimed their name, Panpanipi, which means Deep Lake, Deep Lake. So as I was healing myself, I began to look at my history of my nation, and to understand what my ancestors were gone through, and what my people have gone through. And the reason why I began the healing journey was in 1967. I started to get arthritis up in Manitoba, northern Manitoba. And I got rheumatoid arthritis, and it started to get really bad over there. And in northern Manitoba, they have no specialists. They have no specialized treatment services to deal with what I have. So they sent me to Winnipeg when I was a teenager. And so I started living in Winnipeg, a hospital patient, rehab center. And so far away from my community, far away from my family, far away from my community, and I became Winnipegger, essentially, but because of my health. And while I was involved with the healthcare system, I struggled a lot with depression, being a teenager. And having to deal with a very crippling condition, disability, and I had no healthy ways of coping with it. So I began to use alcohol as a way to cope with it. So I became quite quite alcoholic is what you would, the term is alcoholic is what is easy to understand. So I became alcoholic, and I became really struggling a lot with it. And in the meantime, up north, my family struggling with alcohol. My family, my mother, my dad, and they had alcohol. And I started to see that a lot when I was a teenager, when I was young, to see that alcoholism and domestic violence. I started to see that when I was young. When I was about 12 years old, I started seeing that when my dad became more troubled. So that was part of my life. And when I was in Winnipeg, I was in the care of the agency. They put me in group homes or boarding homes, health boarding homes, while I was in hospital, in and out of hospital. And in the meantime, my family, my brothers and sisters, they got apprehended by the system. They became permanent wards. And my mother and dad lost custody of their children in the late early 70s. And my family became part of the 60s group when they were all in permanent order. And my two youngest siblings, they were adopted out to Ontario, and we didn't see them again until they were in their 20s, when they returned back to Manitoba. And my father and mother never did see them again, because they died before they returned. And so I kind of grew up, you know, dealing with all of that. On top of that, while I was dealing with my growing alcohol addiction, becoming worse and worse, to the point that I became a homeless. I became part of those people you see down Main Street. You see down Thompson, Manitoba. I became part of that group. And so I have an affinity with people that are homeless. And I have an affinity with people who are struggling with addictions. I have a lot of kindness for them. And so I came to struggle with alcohol, and finally 1984 is when I took my last drink, June 28th, 1984. I never drank since that time. Never used marijuana or nothing like that. I started to just look at myself, heal myself. And mentally, I was fortunate to meet a woman. She just dropped me off here. Been married with her for many years. We raised a family. And she is from Selkirk, Manitoba area, where Kyle comes from. They're Métis, Cree. Her mother's side was a Cree from the Selkirk settlements. A lot of her relatives were Peguis. All of her relatives are from Peguis. So my children are Métis heritage, and they also have Cree family. And so as I was healing myself, I was healing myself in 1984. I knew I had to get into some kind of a field. I had to get off of social assistance. I was on social assistance, so I had to find a way to raise a family. Excuse me. And so I started taking courses. I started taking social work courses, psychology courses, and I got a degree. I got a certificate in community development first, and I started working with Mom Wichita Center in 1985, a long time ago, well, for 1985. And I've been working with since ever since then. I've been working with in the social services field. and I got a degree at, in a BSW in social work, all the while maintaining my sobriety. And I got a, I continued my education. I got a master's degree in social work in 2001. All the while, on looking at my history as I was healing. When people are healing, I believe anyway, it's very important to look at our history, to begin to understand where we come from. We need to understand where we come from. Judge Murray Sinclair often talks about that. We need to know where we have come from, to know where we are today. To know where we are today, to know where we're going, we have to know where we are today. So we have to know those three, past, present, and future. And so when I was healing myself, I began to look at that so I can teach my children what I am learning. And in the course of my healing, I started remembering things. I remember growing up in 1951 in a very, very large extended family environment. Before 1950, in that time, there was no such a thing as social services in my community. There was no what they call social assistance, what they call welfare. There was no such a thing as that. There was no senior personal care homes. There was none of that. All the people, whenever there was a tragedy or some kind of personal calamity, and parents couldn't look after their children, those children were taken care of by extended family automatically. There was no paperwork. There was no court system. Automatically, we took care of each family. Took care of that those children, and the elders, the old people, grandparents, grandmothers, they lived with us right up until they died. They live with the family. And so that's how I remember always growing up with my grandparents. I had lots of grandparents when I was growing up, lots of grandmothers. I was told, "That's your grandmother over there." So I would say, "Okay," so I called my grandmother. "That's your grandfather over there." Sure. They tell me to call that one grandfather. So I go call that one grandfather, grandmother. I had about 10 grandmothers, 10 grandfathers in that community. And I grew up thinking that these are my people, my relatives. So it's good to think like that, though. It's good to feel like that, think like that. I was part of a large extended family. And we also by 1951 we were colonized, and we were colonized to United Church. There was United Church, Anglican Church there, and I was baptized in Anglican Church. I went to church every Sunday, and I remember church being Sunday. We worked hard because there's no social services. There's nothing. You can't get any help. You have to help yourself. So 6 days a week, people work hard. People chopped wood, hunted, fished, and trapped to get enough food for the people, get enough food for the family. And whenever they killed a moose, for example, that moose was distributed to all the people who couldn't hunt, the elders who couldn't hunt, the widows who couldn't hunt, the disabled people who couldn't hunt. That meat was distributed, that food was distributed to them first, before, and my dad would bring home a little bit of the meat left over for us. Everything was shared in that way. So we still had that value of sharing and caring. And in that was still there. And the tradition of feasting was also still there. Every Sunday was a day of rest, and I remember liking that day of rest, Sunday. All the people went to church, on Sunday. Nobody worked. You didn't work. You didn't chop wood. Nothing. You went to church. All the people went to church. I remember in my mind seeing a white church with a steeple. We'd all go there that day, and the kids were we were very quiet. We listened to the minister preaching, and we had an hour, however long that service was. Then after the service was over, the adults would visit each other. The woman would visit each other. The men would visit each other. Then we'd have a feast, and the elders would talk. The elders would give long talks. I remember these talks were so long. People just sitting there talking long. We had to hear them talk before we could eat. And I remember thinking, I was a little guy, about that one's age, thinking that I wish they would stop talking so we could eat. I'm getting hungry. But they kept talking. But while they were talking about the history of the community, or history of their ancestors. They're talking about them. They're talking about the value system we had. They're talking about that. And I remember being a young person, being a young child. I spoke Cree. I understood things only in Cree. That's all I understood. And I remember being so paying rapt attention to these elders talking. I would listen to them so carefully. We were told to sit still and listen to the elders. Don't run around. So we never run around. We sat still, all in a circle, waiting. Listen to the elders talking in Cree. And sometimes there'd be two or three or four elders talking, and they would give a long prayer for the food. And Sunday, the whole Sunday was the kids would, after the feast was over, we would play. The kids would play. We'd play with my cousins. We have lots of fun that day. No work at all. Now I remember that Sunday being such a beautiful day. I remember that. And I think that's one of the things I enjoyed about my growing up. And so when I talked to my dad would, he's passed away, my late father, he would talk about the ceremonies that they used to have in Oxford House a long time ago. In 1940, they used to have shaking tent ceremonies there. And I talked, another elder from the community, she's passed away too. I'd go visit her whenever she was in the city. She was my relative, my grandmother, one of my grandmothers, and she would talk about when she was a child, and she was born in early 1900s, and she died in her 90s. And she said, when she was a child, the young men would fast for 7 days. 7 days. I said, holy man, that's long. That's a long time. And they had pipe ceremonies. They had sweat lodge ceremonies. They had shaking tent ceremonies. These are all ceremonies that people practiced. And my dad said, in the 1930s, late 1930s, people started to getting persecuted for these ways, because the Christian people were not understanding what these ceremonies were about. So they started to disallow them, not allow them. And they started persecuting those ones who were practicing these traditional ways, because they were devil's way. So they had to go underground. My dad said they went far away to go have a shake tent ceremony. They went way far into the bush, and they would have a shake tent ceremony over there. I was reminded of the crows there a few months ago. couple of months ago, about a month and a half ago, I was walking in the back alley of my house in East Kildonan, and there was a dead crow in the middle of the road. He must have got hit by something happened to him, that crow. So I picked him up and I put him in the tall grass, and I didn't want him to be run over and crushed. So I put him in tall grass, and then close to my house, right behind my house. And so I was sitting there outside the next day, and there was four crows sitting on the power line, and they were making low noises. They were very quiet. And I realized that they're grieving their loved one that passed away. So the crows are just like us too. They grieve, when they lose somebody. And so that kind of I kind of like that they honor their dead as well, just like us. So in healing myself, like I said, I became a social worker. I became an instructor. I teach university courses, and I'm still teaching university courses. I'm 72 years old. 73 next month, pretty soon. And they want me to teach a course, so I'm going to teach that course. And so I've been teaching for many years, 20, 40. Well, I guess I started doing workshops in 1985. I've been doing workshops since that time. So I started to teach university courses in 1996. And I really enjoy teaching. I really enjoy teaching. I want to become a teacher. And I became all the while healing myself. And I became a therapist. I'm a therapist as well. I do therapy work. So I did work with lots of residential school survivors, lots of them, many, many of them. They heard about me and they said, "Can we come and see you? Can I come and see you? I want to heal myself. I want to. I've been carrying this trauma and pain for some people carry it for 70 years. They never talked about it ever before to anybody in their life. They come and see me, and we sit together. My elder, his name is Peter Rochise. He was 110 years old when he passed away, the old man. He said, when you get into a one-to-one with somebody, there's a golden circle between you and that person. There's a sacred circle. And you must listen. Use your ears, your eyes, everything to listen to that person. And so I always remember that teaching about that golden circle. When somebody is hurting, it doesn't matter who it is, whether it's a child, whether it's one of your relatives. I imagine some of you have old aged parents now who are maybe they're in personal care homes, or maybe they're approaching that last stage of life. They're gonna pass away. And what you need to do is be with them and listen to them, comfort them. And so that's what I was doing when I was doing my therapy work. I work with elders, residential school survivors, 60 scoop survivors. I work with men who are men and young people that are involved in the gangs. I work with them. I work with many, many homeless people that are homeless. Just one-to-one, just sitting with them, talking with them. And so if you want to be an ally, I want you to remember that when you're sitting with somebody, first listen to their story. What is their story? How did they end up coming to that spot, that particular day and time that you're sitting in front of them? And what brought them there to that day? And just be with them and listen to them and begin to connect with them. Relationship is the most important thing. Relationship is the most important thing, eh? So I work with, like I said, I work with people that are being a former homeless, a person who was homeless, a person who was chronically using alcohol. Every day I drank years ago, and I thank the Creator for that. I thank the Creator. Thank God I was saved. Thank God I was saved so I can help people. I can help people. So I use everything. I'm glad I got arthritis. I can say that. Now I can use my arthritis, my experience, to say, I know what it's like to be disabled. I'm not a victim. I recovered from that. I never consider myself disabled. Never consider myself disabled. If you get disabled up here, psychologically crippled, then you're really disabled. If you're not psychologically crippled, you're okay. You can heal yourself. So when I was drinking alcohol, using alcohol, I felt psychologically crippled. I blame my dad for everything. It's my dad's fault. That's why I'm not in school. I blame child welfare. That's why I'm not in school. That's why I didn't have grade 12. I blame my poor teachers because of all of my suffering. I blamed everybody. Once I realized that my dad didn't put alcohol in my mouth, people didn't put alcohol in my mouth, I did that. Okay. Grow up. Start growing up. And so I said, that's the beginning of healing, when you start looking at yourself. Then I say, okay, now that I'm healing myself, what can I do for my family? Work, make an income, contribute to society, not be a burden on society. So I try to be that. But when I work with somebody who's struggling, the way I had struggled, I bring compassion, kindness to that person, because they need kindness and compassion. They need that, so they can move from being a victim to being with me. We can heal each other. I can heal you. I can help you heal. And so that's like 40 years of whatever I was doing. I've been in social work that long. I retired 2 years ago, 3 years ago. But I'm still doing stuff. Not retired. But what happened in December 31st, 2022? I had a heart attack. I had a mild heart attack. So I woke up in lots of pain that morning, New Year's Eve day. I woke up in lots of pain. I was in a bit of a panic. But I didn't wake my wife up. I went to the couch, living room, and I sat there thinking about panicking. And I thought I should wake my wife up, call the ambulance. So I was sitting there thinking, do I want to die in a hallway at the hospital? Or do I want to die here? So I decided I want to die here. I think I'll die here. I don't want to go to the hospital. I don't want to go in a hospital, in a Concordia hospital or someplace, and die in a hallway. COVID is still going strong. And so I just sat there and I started praying. Breathing, because I was panicking, right? Breathing. We have a power. Breathing. We breathe, we can breathe. We can calm your mind with breathing. So I start breathing. About an hour, I start feeling a little better. And the panic went away. My mind is panicking. And the pain is lessening in my chest. Pain is lessening. And then my wife woke up and I told her what happened. And she wanted to call the ambulance right away. I said, No. Don't call the ambulance. She was panicking. She started panicking. Call the ambulance. No. Don't call them. So anyway, she said, okay. She knew I was stubborn. So I said, okay, I want you to go to the walk-in clinic right away. Whenever it's open, Tuesday morning, I get it opens. I went straight there. They did immediate tests and observations on me, and they confirmed that I had a mild heart attack. And they referred me to clinics, specialists. And I eventually got the tests I needed to have done. They said it's a mild heart attack. So they put me on some high blood pressure, aspirin pills. But when you have something like that happen to you, you do some reflection. So I told my wife, I said, when I die, this is what you do. So I started scaring her. And I said, I guess we have to, we're both at the age, she's getting older too. I said, we can't ignore that. We can't ignore that. We have to start thinking about it. I have my will up to date. My will has been up to date. And my wife and I talked about it. We talked about it. It's something that has to be talked about. You can't wait. You can't wait. And it doesn't have to be morbid. It's nothing morbid. It's real life, realistic. We're going to talk about it. And if you have old parents that are old, some of you probably have parents that are old, you got to talk about it with them. Because they may be scared. They may want to talk about it. And you have to make it okay to talk about it. Make it okay. And so I start thinking about it, talking about it, thinking about it, and talking about it. So I stopped all of my activities, most of them. I was involved with boards, committees, all kinds of things I was doing. Every day I was going someplace. And my wife said, I thought you were retired. I thought you were retired. Where the hell are you going now? I'm going. But I stopped most of them. I stopped about 75% of them. And I started taking care of myself. I started slowing down. Got to slow down, eh? And so sometimes it takes something like that to make you reflect on your life. Something happens to somebody in your circle, it makes you reflect on your life. It makes you think of what's important. What's important, eh? What's really important to do. But I still conduct Sweat Lodge, not as much. I still conduct Sweat Lodge, not as much. I still like Sweat Lodge. I still like going to Sweat Lodge. I still like going to gatherings like this. I still like. Because this is ceremony. This is ceremony here. What we're doing here is ceremony. When you connect with nature, you know, you get to be here. Beautiful nature. And you get to... When I was growing up, I went to every park. Every park in southern Manitoba. Winnipeg. With my kids. And the little ones. They have to experience that. And I realized, and the resentment I felt for my dad, I had deep, deep resentment. One day I went to ceremony. I was taking people to ceremonies. And this lady said to me, Don, can you take me to a ceremony? My grandmother died, and I can't go home to the community. I can't go home to the reserve. But I called my elder, my knowledge keeper. I asked, is there a ceremony I can do? She said, bring So he told her, "You can come do a paper ceremony for you. A special ceremony for the departed. When people die, they have a ceremony for that." And so she said, "She's on social assistance. She has no means of travel." So she called me and said, "Can you take me there?" I said, "Sure, I'll take you there." So I took her to the about 50 miles from here, Broken Head. And she took berries, cloth, tobacco. And she took them to that place. And we went to a room. It is in the basement. And it's all dark in that room. Everything's black, pitch black in there. And they start doing the ceremony. And she said, during the ceremony, the conductor, pipe ceremony guy said to her, "When the ceremony starts, pipe ceremony starts, your grandmother's going to come into this room here, and you can talk to her. She's going to come here. You can talk to her. That's the kind of ceremony it is. Chiwai ceremony, it's called a Chiwai ceremony, ghost pipe." And so she, when the time came, the elder said, "You can talk to your grandmother now." And so she's able to grieve and tell her grandmother how much she loved her grandmother, how sad she was she couldn't make it to her when she was getting ill, and when she passed away she couldn't make it there. So she was able to talk to her and bring out tears and say goodbye. And she said, "Your grandmother's going to over the bridge now to the spirit world. She hears you, and you can be happy for her." So she was very happy that she did that ceremony, and it was done. But anyway, while I was sitting there supporting her, the elder said, "Don, your father's here. Your dad's here. Your dad's here. Your dad's been here. Your dad's been waiting for a long, long time. He died in 1990. I never grieved him because I still had resentment. And he said, your dad is here. And he knows you got something to say to him. He knows that. You can't go until you speak to him." That was the day I forgave my dad. I talked to him. I cried. And he said, "Now your dad is going to the spirit world now. Your dad is traveling now. And that's the power of ceremony. That's the power of pipe ceremonies. To do that. To have that forgiveness. And over the years, I've forgiven my mother. My mother was a very kind person. And I forgive my dad. And my dad gave me the gift of loving nature. My dad, when I took my kids to the all the parks I took my kids to, I realized during the time that it was my dad that taught me to love nature. Going to all the parks I went to is because of my dad. My dad took me everywhere when I was a kid. He took me everywhere. Hunting around. Walking around, eh? And so I really thank my dad for the gifts of that nature. And my mother was a very humble woman, very quiet woman. But I know she loved me, but she never said I love you. But one of the things she used to do is when she traveled, she always bought me books. Books. Every time she came back, she had a book for me, a book or two. And to this day, I love reading. I read at least 52 books a year, one book a week. That's how many books I read. I read more than that. But it's because of my mother. That's why I love reading. And I passed that love of reading on to my daughter. My daughter loves reading. And so my children are growing up. So that's the gifts we get from people in our life. So I've been, you know, healing journey for a long time. And I've been sharing my, I volunteer, I go to groups where there's people that are, I went to Pritchard House a number of times. I go talk to people that are recovering from alcohol drug addictions. I share my what knowledge I have, wisdom I have, and whenever I get a chance to go speak somewhere, I go share my story with them, because I want people to know that you can heal yourself. You can heal yourself. You don't have to be you don't have to be pitiful. Mm-hmm. You can heal yourself. But when you're pitiful, you need compassion. You need compassion. Eh? So as allies, your allies, looking in your groups, you're doing church work, you're doing healing work. The work you're doing, the reason why you're sitting here is because you care. You care. And you're bringing that caring to your family. Some of you are here with your son. You're bringing that. You want to transfer that to your son. What you're caring, eh? And she's here with her daughter, this one here, and she's here with her son, Teresa. You're passing it on. Whatever you have, you're passing it on to your children. You're passing it on. You're not keeping it. You're not. It's not selfish. Love is not selfish. Kindness is not selfish. It's not selfish. Compassion is not selfish. All those sacred teachings, they're not selfish. They're not just for us. It's for everybody. For everybody. It's for everything. So I try to practice what I try to practice what I preach. I never leave garbage anywhere. If I go do something, if I go have a feast or something, I tell the people, make sure we leave the place as quiet, as clean as we left it, as it was when we left it. Take all your garbage. When I go do a sweat lodge, I make sure every garbage we bought there, everything we bought there, it's clean. We take it back to the city with us. Deposit it somewhere in a recycling bin. My daughter came home from school when she was 6 years, grade one. And we were not recycling back then yet. And my daughter came home from school. She's 33 years old now, 34 years old now. But she was 6 years old. She came home from school. She was 6 years old. She said, she started digging through the garbage. Dad, Mom, what are you doing? This is recycling. This is recycling. She started giving us heck. They're recycling. So every day she'd come home from school looking at garbage. So we started recycling. We've been recycling ever since then. My daughter, she's 6 years old. She taught us that. So we can learn from the kids. We can learn from the kids. We're not all knowing. We can learn from the kids. They teach us, eh? Anyway, to summarize, and you can ask questions of me. Now, I carry that pipe. I carry that pipe, that chibai pipe. I carry that. Help people when they lose somebody. I can do that kind of ceremony. And I carry the sweat lodge ceremony. I can do that. But I don't have a gift to give names. I don't have a gift to give names. There's people that can do that. I don't have a gift to give names. So our elders, knowledge keepers, they have gifts in different areas. And they're knowledgeable in certain areas. There's some elders that are really knowledgeable about the medicines. About the medicines. There's a medicine there. That medicine there might contain cure for cancer. I don't know. My elder said when I was suffering from pain, suffering from arthritis. I had a swollen knee like this. Both of them were swollen. I could hardly walk. So I went to see an elder. First time in my life, I went to see an elder. And he said, look over there. We went for a walk in a bush. He said, look, there's a willow there, willow. He said, when you peel the bark from that willow, it's a red willow. The bark contains the same medicine as in that is in aspirin, acetylsalicylic acid. It contains the same compound. So we went to the bush. He went. I couldn't walk. My knees were too swollen. And he picked five different willows, different kinds of willows: cranberry willow, red willow, gray willow. There was five different willows he picked. And he gave me another different medicine. And he said, go home, take a pail, a big pail like this, big pail, one of those big garbage pails. I don't know how many gallons it is. He said, I want you to make medicine. Take all the bark off all these willows. Give me some willows. So I took all the bark off. And he said, boil it for about half an hour. And he said, put all that medicine inside of a, strain it and put it inside of a pail. I was taking 200 Tylenol trees every month, quite a few a day, and the pain didn't subside. I was getting addicted to using that Tylenol 3. So he said, take that. He said, stop taking. First thing he said, stop taking Tylenol 3. That's killing you. It's killing you. Stop taking it. He said, okay, stop. I'll stop taking it. So I said, I followed this big white pail of medicine. He said, drink it all up in 4 days. So I drank it up in all of it in 4 days. So I was peeing, pooping, and in 4 days, this knee went down to almost normal, and this knee went down about 75-80%. Gone. Water is gone. And I said, I like this. I think I'll start going some more. So I started going to Sweat Lodge. Never stopped going since. So that willow you see over there, it could have a cure for something. I don't know. But I know about some medicine. I'm not a medicine man. Everything's a medicine. Everything. And we just have to learn about it, I guess. Learn about it. We don't know. So that's only a small bit of my story, small bit, that I hope will help you in your journey. It's all about learning about yourself. What can I do? I can play a small part in healing the forest. The small part can be, like Kyle said, just picking up the garbage. Just picking up a piece of garbage you see. That's a small part. But it helps, eh? It helps. And we are all related. We are all related. All of us. It's one of the beliefs across, it's common across our First Nations. That teaching of we are all related. We're all related. We need each other. In order to survive, we need each other. We cannot survive alone. We need a. In my community, there's four churches now. Four churches that divide us. And the churches that my relatives, many of them are religious. Some Christian denomination, and some of them think I'm going to hell because I go to Sweat Lodge. They think I'm practicing the heathen ways I'm going to hell. But all I do is tell them, all I'm doing is I go pray. I go pray to the Creator. I pray for good life. I pray for everybody. I pray for Christians. I pray for our brothers in Africa, our brothers in Asia, our brothers in Ukraine that are struggling in that war, the wars, Ukraine, Russia. Brutal wars are brutal. I pray for them. I took tobacco out for the Ukrainian war to end. I took tobacco out to a sweat lodge, made an offering. Because I would like to see that. I'd like to see that come to a peaceful conclusion. Same with Gaza. I'd like to see peaceful conclusion. So the kids can be safe. Families can be safe. We need peace, eh? We need that. And I think I can probably stop there. But thank you for this tobacco. Thank you for this cloth. I will use that in my travels. So I hope I was able to give you a little bit, a seed that you can use. A seed that you can use, eh?